It's hard to say who exactly is high on Captagon, but one thing is certain. For Syrians surrounded by fighters, it's got to be even more frightening that some of them may be jumpy, agitated, and have a hair trigger because they're on the drug. It just makes fleeing Syria all the more tempting. And even as I speak, the flow of people has not stopped. Of course, many of those who have left have lost their lives on the way to Europe. That's what happened to a family member of my next guest, Zina Aga. Zina is an Iraqi-Palestinian poet who has family in Syria. She told me what happened to her cousin.
My auntie, my father's sister, lives in Damascus, and she had 10 children. And very beautiful family, very warm and loving. Out of her 10 children, one was taken prisoner, and we don't know what's happened there. And the other one, who is a 26-year-old engineer, wanted a better life in Fortress Europe and got on a migrant dinghy, paid one of the smugglers about £1,000 to go from Turkey to Greece. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, but we believe that by the time that he got to Greece, the Greek authorities turned them away. And it was on the return back to Turkey that the dinghy capsized and they drowned.
What went through your mind when you heard that news, especially given all the other thousands of people who've lost their lives in the Mediterranean?
I found out a year ago, and honestly, the thing I felt immediately was irony, because 2 weeks before, I'd gone to Granada, to Spain, off just for a weekend, and I actually wrote a Facebook status being like, took a photo of my British passport and wrote, "This is the passport that lets me go wherever I want, and people are dying in boats." And then 2 weeks later, I'd found out that around 2 weeks before, my cousin had actually been one of them. So inadvertently, I'd sort of stumbled into this narrative without even being part of it. And my father was very deadpan in his delivery and quite resigned to it. But I think for me, especially kind of with that young optimism that I think so many early teens have when they look at this crisis, I was just sort of filled with this crippling sense of injustice. And it sounds bizarre, but guilt, the idea of like, there literally is no difference between us and this is how I'm living. These basic things I take for granted, my people are suffering from not having them.
Yeah, that sense of survivor's guilt almost.
Yeah, in many ways.
Like I said, Zina is a poet, and I'd like you to hear a part of a poem she wrote after the death of her cousin. It's called "The Sea Is Big."
I have nothing to add. It is all said. Of bodies and shores and salted tears in the salted seas and memorials in dinghies capsized and memories in homes blasted, bombed and ransacked. A deficit of humanity. Facing trouble at home displaced and disgraced, facing borders not of our own misplaced and mistakes, no choice but to flee.
I asked Zina how poetry has helped her get through that personal tragedy and the larger one at hand.
Poetry's been a lifeline. I think everyone needs a form of expression for these sorts of events, otherwise they go mad, whether or not they have a relationship to the region. It's a form of self-brutalization to constantly see these images on your TV and then switch it on and carry on with your life. And for me, my form of expression comes with poetry. I kind of fell into poetry. I didn't ever intend on doing it, and I don't really intend on spending my life doing it. It's just something I really enjoy doing and something I actually need to articulate my confusion. It's resonated with people, thankfully, and I think that's just because we all are kind of looking for some artistic understanding of what is going on that isn't just, you know, the sensationalism of the TV or the dryness of the political speeches in the UN or wherever else.
I mean, it's interesting because last week at Harvard, I heard you read "The Sea Is Big," and it struck me that a poem about the loss of a loved one, you know, brings home the crisis at a personal level, but it feels kind of powerless too in the face of this grinding war. On the other hand, hearing a poem talking about this tragedy was something I had not heard really yet. So I'm just wondering how art in general does help in these nightmarish moments.
Enormously, at least for me. I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but enormously, because I think we, like I said, we spend so much time just internalizing all of this trauma on the TV as viewers, as consumers of this news. And actually what art does, it brings you into the debate. It engages your heart, not just your head. And hopefully by extension, your hands as well. So you actually start making a difference. And I also think, you know, in our nature, if I can be so bold to say such a thing as human nature, we find ourselves inextricably leaning towards creativity. And, you know, it's why we like music and film and theatre and all those things, just to entertain us. And it's a double-edged sword, because it can entertain us, but it can also open our eyes to things that media or, you know, newspapers alone just can't articulate. It has a kind of tenderness to it that very few things do. And I think if you sideline art, especially in times of crisis, you turn a tragic situation into a completely unsalvageable one, because there's no hope left.
Iraqi-Palestinian poet Zina Agha. By the way, at PRI.org, we've got video of Zina reading her poem, The Sea is Big.